96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Ifmali Casius with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, July 16th. A new poll is raising questions about whether Florida's redrawn 14th congressional district could be more competitive than Republicans expected. The district was reshaped after Governor Ron DeSantis pushed for new congressional maps designed to give Republicans an advantage and make longtime Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor's seat more favorable to the GOP. But a new St. Pete poll survey shows Castor currently leading the top two Republican candidates in the Tampa area district. Some Democrats are questioning whether the new map could become what's known as a dummy mander. This is a district drawn to help one party that ends up producing the opposite result. The race is still developing, with many voters undecided and Republicans still choosing their nominee. The Republican primary is set for August, and the winner will face Castor in the November election. Meanwhile, a Democratic candidate running for Florida's 16th congressional district says his early fundraising numbers show strong grassroots support in the race to flip the seat. Kelly Kirshner says his campaign raised nearly $224,000 during its first quarter, with more than 500 individual donors contributing. He compared his fundraising to Republican candidate Sidney Gruder's, who raised nearly $1 million during the same period. Kirshner says having more individual donors shows growing support among voters in the district. He also points to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee recently adding the race to its list of competitive districts this fall. The race is for the seat currently held by Republican Congressman Vern Buchanan, who is retiring. The recently redrawn district includes Manatee, DeSoto, and Hardy, as well as parts of Sarasota and Pinellas counties. Gruders is facing two contenders in the Republican primary, while Kirshner is one of five Democrats seeking the nomination. A Bradenton music venue is moving to a new location after the owner says ongoing conflicts with neighbors made it difficult to continue operating in the Village of the Arts. Cottonmouth Southern Soul Food opened in 2020 and became known for its food and live music events. Earlier this year, the Bradenton City Council voted to allow the restaurant's live music to continue, but owner Dave Shiplett says tensions with the nearby residents remained. Now, Cottonmouth is moving south to partner with Flamingo Bay Brewing Company on 14th Street West in Bradenton. This has been Ifmali Casius with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, July 16th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with your music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. This week's hearings in the Senate for new members of the Trump cabinet revealed something I guess everybody knows. The whole strategy Republicans hope to employ in the midterms is to claim the election was stolen and point to the 2020 election is evidence of how elections are stolen. Of course, just saying so does not make it so. So that thorny problem of having proof still plagues the orange menace of Palm Beach. Todd Blanche, acting attorney general, is up for the permanent job, and Jay Clayton is up to head national intelligence groups. both, when asked who won the 2020 election, gave the ambiguous answer that left the door open to the argument that there were, quote, irregularities that were not properly investigated. I suppose the 60-plus lawsuits brought back in 2020 by the loser Trump that never even came close to establishing any trickery do not count. Do not expect a quick conclusion to the midterms, which I can bet the administration and his appointed lackeys will baselessly challenge ad nauseum. Stay tuned until 11:30 to hear my conversation with Greg Grubel, an attorney with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, who recently won the case that overturned parts of the Stop Woke Act. But first, hear how perhaps the most brazen abuse of power of this administration was struck down. A federal judge ruled this week that President Trump's lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service was an improper exercise in self-dealing and barred him from claiming that the extraordinary tax protections he received were part of a legitimate settlement agreement. In the 56-page order, the judge, Kathleen M. Williams, also referred the lawyer who brought Mr. Trump's case against the IRS to the Florida bar for potential disciplinary proceedings. She added that she would forward her decision to the New York bar for its continuing investigation of the acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, who faces a Senate confirmation hearing this week. The decision by Judge Williams, who sits in this federal district in Miami, did not explicitly kill the deal that Trump had worked out with his own government to receive what amounted to amnesty from IRS investigations. But the scathing ruling exposed the negotiations between Mr. Trump's personal lawyers and senior officials at the Justice Department for what she said were backroom dealings that did not arise from a legitimate legal process. The nature of the suit itself and the conduct of the parties and counsel from its filing make it plain that this was an attempt to use the court to provide some legitimacy to an agreement to confer immunity to people and entities affiliated with the president, the judge wrote. The ruling was the latest example of a federal judge calling out the Trump administration for twisting normal court procedures to the president's advantage. Mr. Trump has repeatedly used the criminal justice system to pursue and punish those he believes to be his enemies. But in this case, Judge Williams wrote, he sought to use the civil legal system to benefit himself, even though the law did not allow it. Whatever may be the party's wishes, inclinations, or the dictates of their passion, she wrote, they cannot alter the state of the facts or evade the rule of law. In January, Mr. Trump sued the IRS, blaming it for the leak of his tax returns during his first term and demanded at least $10 billion in damages. But rather than taking the typical steps to defend the agency against Mr. Trump's claims, the Justice Department instead reached what it called a settlement agreement that included two remarkable provisions. The first created a $1.8 billion fund aimed at compensating allies of Mr. Trump who say they were victims of so-called government weaponization. The prospect of Mr. Trump's administration making extensive payouts to people who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, immediately set off a political firestorm, and Mr. Blanche later said the Justice Department would not move forward with the fund. But Mr. Blanche, Mr. Trump's former personal lawyer, had also signed a separate order granting the president and his family and their businesses wide-ranging and unprecedented immunity from tax inquiries. He directed the IRS to stop any ongoing audits of the Trumps and also told the agency to not conduct any new investigations of the tax returns they had already filed. That protection from audits, potentially very valuable for Mr. Trump, who has aggressively avoided taxes throughout his life, did not attract the same political pushback from Republicans. Mr. Blanche has said it will remain in place. until Judge Williams' order, Mr. Trump and his family are prohibited from calling the audit protections a settlement in the official proceedings, but it is unclear if it would otherwise prevent Mr. Trump and the many companies affiliated with him and his family from relying on it to escape IRS scrutiny. An adverse ruling in just one IRS examination of Mr. Trump could have cost him more than $100 million, the New York Times has reported. Experts have doubted whether Mr. Blanche even had the authority to direct the IRS to stop audits, and Judge Williams said his directive violated a federal law preventing the White House from controlling IRS investigations. It is also unclear if the IRS has carried out Mr. Blanche's order, now almost 2 months old. In her ruling, Judge Williams took aim at Mr. Blanche at a sensitive moment, days before he was to appear in the Senate for his confirmation hearing as Attorney General. She wrote that she was extremely troubled by the testimony he gave to the Senate in May when he asserted that the settlement agreement had never been submitted to a court because the case had been dismissed and there was no mechanism for reviewing the agreement. This answer is at best misleading and at worst disingenuous, the judge wrote. The court was available to review any pleading by any party at any time during this lawsuit. Judge Williams also opened up the possibility of Mr. Trump having to pay monetary penalties to the penalties in the case. Several third parties have filed friend of the court briefs in the case, and she said those lawyers could request reimbursement from Mr. Trump for their costs. The immigration crackdown is costing Florida a lot of important workers. The state could be faced with the double impact of a new rule proposed by the Department of Homeland Security that would remove work permits, as well as the effects stemming from a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that upheld the Trump administration's authority to revoke temporary protected status for Haitians and Syrians. Everything happening in immigration impacts the economy, said Tessa Petit, the executive director of the Florida Immigration Coalition. Non-immigrants need to be aware that somehow they get impacted. They're going to see that there's not going to be grocery workers, no farm workers. The cost of construction has already increased in Florida because of the loss of construction workers. The cost of living is only going to get worse. Kicking out asylum applicants could eliminate almost $22 billion in income from the Florida economy each year, according to the research from the nonprofit Work Permits US. It would also create a substantial void in the workforce. Asylum applicants account for more than 500,000 workers in Florida, including about 100,000 in the construction industry, according to a new report by Philip Connor, a researcher at the Princeton University Center for Migration and Development. This would be on top of the 93,000 TPS holders in Florida whose status is also being threatened and contribute an estimated $2.6 billion annually, according to the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Immigrants whose TPS status have been revoked sometimes have work permits through asylum applications, but that is now at risk. Christina Moreno, policy counsel at Work Permits US, said this would have a destabilizing effect on U.S. businesses, but especially for South Florida businesses. Jason Pincus, vice president and nursing home administrator at the Miami Jewish Health, said the company will have to reduce the number of beds in its nursing homes, even as elderly population continues to grow. Hospitality leaders have raised similar concerns. Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association and the National Restaurant Association sent a letter last month to Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen warning that removing work authorization would create an operational shock for restaurants and hotels, particularly during the busy summer season. I think there's so many ways that they're going against their own best interests, said Anna Sophia Pelez, co-founder and executive director of the Miami Freedom Project. Up until now, very recently, there was an understanding that immigration is a strength of our country and that it's been an engine for our economy. Then people saw an opportunity to politicize that and to create a kind of resentment. They took it, and in some ways, that's become the perfect scapegoat. The Trump administration has justified the removal of immigrant workers from the workforce by arguing it would open up more jobs for U.S.-born citizens. We're now seeing the reverse migration as migrants go back home, leaving more housing, more jobs for Americans. In the year before my election, all net creation of jobs was going to foreign migrants, Trump said in an address to the nation in December of last year. Since I took office, 100% of all net job creation has gone to American-born citizens. However, the recent research by Work Permit U.S. shows that the principal industries employing asylum applicants collectively employ an estimated 2.3 million asylum applicants, while also accounting for around 7.2 million job openings. For the workers facing the uncertainty of losing their status, the policies have brought a new wave of anxiety. A South Florida Haitian woman whose TPS status was recently revoked, whose name the Trib is withholding because she fears retaliation, is grappling with being forced back into the shadows of the country she lives in. When she was 17, her father was assassinated and she had to move neighborhoods to stay safe. Eventually, she migrated to the U.S. to be completely safe and to reunite with her mother, who was already living here. Having to live in fear is something I didn't believe that I would experience in the United States, she said in an interview. In a country that supposedly respects every human's dignity and human rights. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Among the workers the state is losing are caregivers for our elderly and infirmed. Florida could quickly lose tens of thousands of its critically needed health care workers who have been at the front lines of caring for the state's aging population. State industry leaders are warning the federal government. An estimated 145,000 Haitian nationals who reside in Florida, of which an estimated 25% work in health care, are facing removal from the country because of a June 25th U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows the Trump administration to revoke these Haitian nationals' temporary status, thus their permission to be in the country. Friday, June 10th, was announced that the last day these Haitian nationals here through TPS could work legally. And on January 10th, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration put out an update that names Friday, July 24th, as the day that work authorization would expire for Haitian nationals here through TPS, but revoking their authorization to work here and deporting them, as some federal officials have threatened, will destabilize the care of hundreds of thousands of aging Floridians, according to a letter from J. Emmett Reed, Chief Executive Officer of the Florida Healthcare Association. He's urging the feds to consider an exemption that allows the affected critical long-term care workers to pursue a lawful path to immigration as they keep working. Florida is home to one of the nation's largest and fastest-growing old adult populations, and demand for long-term care services continues to increase each year, he wrote to the Department of Homeland Security. The Haitian nationals working in health care and here through the temporary status program comprise about 3% of the 1.25 million people, which a national health policy organization, KFF, counts as working in Florida's healthcare system, according to estimates. Local care coordinators confirm that many of these Haitian nationals are doing a large part, proportionally speaking, of the hands-on caregiving, many of them for years and years. But since the ruling, it appears no direct federal guidance has been given to the businesses which contract with health aides, certified nursing assistants, and licensed practical nurses to put them in private homes, assisted living facilities, and nursing homes where they are needed. One assisted living facility owner in Boynton Beach said he's been Googling it and came through to the conclusion that he can keep paying at least one employee he knows is here through TPS. Another nurse registry concluded after reading the federal website, the TPS workers' authorization to get paid expired July 10th. It's widely agreed, though, that losing 35,000 healthcare workers overnight would create an immediate staffing shortage. In a July 7th letter to Mark Wayne Mullen, director of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Reed said these workers are essential and frontline as part of a fragile workforce. Any significant reduction in the available workforce would make it more difficult to serve current and new residents, causing a ripple effect that could overwhelm our local hospitals and our entire healthcare system, the top advocate for Florida's nursing homes wrote. The individuals potentially affected by these changes are not simply employees. They are experienced caregivers who have become integral members of our care teams. Marissa Sterner, a regional director and co-operator of Better Healthcare LLC, a nurse registry serving South Florida, said she's had to terminate a handful of contracted workers among the 100 she contracts with, considering the Supreme Court ruling. And it's upset some of her clients, she said. It's sad because the clients' families love them, absolutely love them, she said, of licensed workers who've been with her agency for years and years. Alligator Alcatraz may be closed, but the work to fix the damage needs to begin. Alligator Alcatraz, a recently closed immigration detention center in the heart of the Everglades, is officially boarded up. Conservation group Friends of the Everglades reported in a Facebook post July 13th. On June 25th, Governor Ron DeSantis officially announced the facility was closing with significant progress in dismantling of the site expected within 7 to 10 days. As of July 13th, the gates are locked and the highway sign marking the entrance has been taken down, but Executive Director of Friends of the Everglades, Eve Samples, wants to make sure what was there isn't forgotten. Seeing the sign come down felt like a moment, the end of a dark chapter in Florida's history, Sample said, and we think that sign should be replaced by a historic marker that commemorates the battle that had been fought and won in the Everglades over the decades. Even though the sign is gone, it doesn't mean all evidence of detention facility is gone. Within 20 acres of asphalt not previously at the site, seen in aerial photos, she said. The story is not over, Sample said, as the group continues to fight for change. The next step, according to the group, is fighting for full remediation of the area, regaining public access to the land, and ensuring permanent protection of the site. Friends of the Everglades has opposed Alligator Alcatraz since it opened in July of last year, even suing the parties responsible for its construction, with no plans to drop it amid the facility's closure. In June 2025, the group filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security for failing to follow the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires an environmental impact review before construction starts on major federal projects. Environmental impacts were not studied before Alligator Alcatraz was built. The group has also expressed its intent to sue over other environmental violations. The Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida joined the Friends of the Everglades June 2025 lawsuit in hopes of protecting tribal rights. Our lawsuit is still very much active, Sample said, with the case returning to the trial court. Examining all of our legal options to hold the government accountable for the damage it caused in the Everglades is an immense expense to taxpayers, at an immense expense to taxpayers. Samples wants to see the officials held accountable, along with full remediation of the area and the insurance that public lands are protected so that it never happens again, she says. The Friends of the Everglades legal team is currently working on putting together the strongest legal strategy possible to hold the government accountable, according to Samples. Reporting the news is more challenging than ever when uncovering an important story may mean a court date. The New York Times said on July 11th that the U.S. Department of Justice had ordered several of its journalists to testify before a grand jury after they reported on security concerns involving President Trump's new Qatari-owned Air Force One. The media organization said subpoenas were issued on July 10th, asking that the journalists appear before a grand jury on July 15th to testify in regard to an alleged violation of federal criminal law. The subpoenas were issued by Jay Clayton, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, and in some cases delivered to the reporters' homes by federal agents, the news outlet reported. It described the move as an extraordinary escalation of President Trump's efforts to threaten, intimidate, and intimidate independent news organizations. In a statement to Reuters, a Department of Justice spokesperson did not confirm or deny the subpoenas, but said the administration was not targeting reporters, but was concerned about the people leaking classified information. The White House referred all questions to the Justice Department. Journalism advocacy groups criticized the subpoenas as a threat to press freedom and constitutional rights. The National Press Club urged the Justice Department to immediately withdraw the subpoenas. When federal agents arrive at the homes of journalists with subpoenas, it is not ordinary law enforcement, the club said in a statement. It is an extraordinary assault on the freedom of the press that strikes at the heart of the First Amendment. Clayton was recently nominated by Trump to lead the office of the Director of National Intelligence. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press called on the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee to hold Clayton accountable when he appears for his confirmation hearing on July 15th. When the public's right to know is crushed, the Trump administration is trying to do with its subpoenas against the New York Times, all of us suffer irreparable harm, as is the freedom upon which this nation is built, Stephen J. Adler, chairman of the Reporters Committee, said in a statement. Trump said on July 8th that he would use the older Air Force One for old time's sake to fly from Ankara, Turkey to the Royal Air Base in Mindenhall in Britain, while the new plane stopped at the same base so U.S. service members stationed there could tour the aircraft. Recent polls show insurance costs are prompting many people to be sure they vote. A new study by Insurify reveals that 65% of Florida respondents say rising insurance costs are making them more likely to vote, with the issue taking center stage in the governor's race. The only way our voice can be heard is through voting, said Christian Barton of LaBelle, Florida. It's the most expensive state for home insurance, with the average statewide policy costing $8,400, according to Insurify. Barton said it's affecting people's pockets now directly as far as everyday living. On the Gulf Coast, insurance rates average $5,000 or more. Judy Lemon of Fort Myers said other rising insurance costs are also influencing her decision to vote. The car insurance has absolutely skyrocketed this year, and I know I will definitely be going to the polls to add my vote, Lennon said. The Assurify highlights insurance affordability as a top issue in Florida's governor's race. Republican candidate Jay Collins said, insurance, absolutely we can save money. We have 17 insurance companies now and more coming in. Another Republican candidate, James Fishback, said, "You have to stand up to the property insurers that are ripping people off." Paul Renner, also a Republican candidate, said, "My plan as governor would be to reduce those rates by 10 to 20%. Republican-turned-Democrat candidate David Jolly said, "I think voters across Florida are ready for a change." With 29 candidates from both parties vying for the governor's seat, voters are considering their options. When asked if she had decided on which candidate for the governor she would vote for, Barton said, "I have not. I am still weighing the options." As property taxes and insurance costs dominate the debate, the issue remains a key focus for candidates and voters alike. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Greg Grubel, an attorney with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome attorney Greg Grubel from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE, who are a nonpartisan leading defender of fundamental free speech rights on college campuses through a unique mix of programming, including student and faculty outreach, public education campaigns, individual case advocacy, and policy reforms. Hey, thanks for coming on today, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Just, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work with FIRE.
Sure. So I grew up in Iowa. I was a philosophy major in college at the University of Northern Iowa, where I had some really amazing professors that, you know, taught me how to think, and did so in a, you know, rural state of Iowa, but went to public school my entire life there and always had really great time. I went to law school out on the east coast of Villanova, also had a lot of great professors there. And then I spent about 4 years at a large labor and employment law firm doing various employment cases, including First Amendment work, and then came to FIRE in 2019 and started doing cases. We were then the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, so our work was solely focused on protecting the rights of students and faculty members in higher education, and then we expanded that mission to include not just professors and students, but all Americans' First Amendment rights, because we saw there was a growing need for an organization to do that kind of work. And, you know, so since then, been doing more general First Amendment work, but really my area of expertise that I've always been developing is public employee speech. And especially now with this case and some others, First Amendment law on academic freedom as it relates to public employee speech.
Let's just start, you know, with, what's come up here in Florida. You know, it took a while and several trips to appeal courts, but, you know, the recently divided 2-1 panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals to the 11th Circuit dealt possibly the final blow to the so-called Stop Woke Act, touted by the DeSantis administration. You know, the judges affirmed 2022 decision and that labeled Florida's rules as positively dystopian, doubling down by arguing that the law is breathtakingly an assertion of power to ban unpopular ideas from public discourse in the very classroom space where students are supposed to puzzle through the ideas that are good and bad, easy and hard, ideally to get closer to the truth, unquote. FIRE was part of the process, suing on behalf of, I guess, a couple of professors from University of South Florida and some students, too. What was their case about?
Yeah, so we actually only represented one professor, Dr. Adriana Novoa, who's a cultural historian whose work is focused primarily on Latin American history. She also teaches about the history of sports in a class that is was implicated here by the Stop Woke Act, and then we represented the students of the First Amendment Forum, which is a student group founded by a former FIRE intern that has been really doing incredible work at the University of South Florida since they got going, not in, you know, in no small part, this case, too. And they've been doing really excellent stuff down there. So Dr. Navoa taught her classes always deal with race when you're teaching about Latin American history. And the same thing with her history of sports class. You know, when you're talking about things like segregation and baseball, one of the things that she taught that the district court said that would violate the Stop Woke Act was a reading on Jackie Robinson's legacy. And that reading made the argument that some part or in some ways the United States remains segregated by race, and that, you know, there are certain privileges that folks have that other folks don't have based on their race, and that was one of the things that could have gotten her fired if she taught that, if the Stop Woke Act were allowed to go into effect. So and then some other things she was teaching that were also prohibited were things about the extermination of indigenous populations in Latin America that dealt with, you know, how people were sort of targeted based upon their race during those times and the fallout from it throughout the 20th century. So there was, you know, just standard stuff that you would learn in college. These are, you know, difficult topics to discuss, but what Florida was trying to do was to say that if you promote any of these ideas, any of the idea that, you know, affirmative action might have merit, that would be per se discriminatory harassment and grounds for immediate termination from the university for Dr. Navoa.
Yeah, that was right. That's, you know, came up this whole business about how, you know, there were some things, you know, that were being taught that might make, you know, white students uncomfortable or feel guilty, mm-hmm. and that was prohibited by this law. You know, mm-hmm. which to me, I find that kind of hard to enforce. You know, I mean, how do you determine, you know, how uncomfortable a student might feel, you know, learning that, you know, for instance, you know, white people own slaves, and making right. the basic statement that, you know, slavery was a bad thing, and that perhaps white people shouldn't have done that to black people. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is that what we're talking about? I mean, to me, that seems, you know, unenforceable. I mean, you know, did the court get into that?
Well, the court did say it was vague. You know, the lower court said it was vague, and I think that was absolutely correct. And I think what you're touching on is exactly right, though, that you can talk. What the Stop Woke Act basically was trying to do is that you can talk about, you know, the fact that slavery existed, but you can't say that if there's anything today that remains influenced by that system that we had. And, you know, I think that's the real problem is that, you know, Dr. Navoa, to be very clear, is not indoctrinating students. She's never been someone who goes into class and gets up on the, you know, stands there and lectures people about her personal views about things. She is a really excellent professor who wants students to come to her classroom and engage in thoughtful debate and learn how to think, not learn what she thinks about something and take that as the correct answer. She wants to give students the tools so that once they're out in the world, they can think for themselves. They can have opinions that might be not in the mainstream. And, you know, it doesn't matter for her or for the students at the First Amendment Forum what conclusion you actually reach. The problem is with this law is that it's trying to cut off the part where you learn things at the core. And that's really the danger with these kinds of laws. And I think exactly the 11th Circuit got it right here by striking it down and saying that the government and not allowing a difference of opinion to be discrimination.
Yeah, and this of course brings up, you know, which is something that the in Florida, you know, carried down to, you know, elementary schools, even though there was no evidence that it was being taught. But, you know, a thing called critical race theory, which is usually taught in law schools or had been taught in law schools, you know, and that was, you know, part of, I guess, the impetus to pass this law, that the idea that was the critical race theory said that, you know, it was systemic, that black people had been mistreated through the course of history, and that, right, I mean, that was part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what the Stop Act, Stop Woke Act was trying to do is sort of say you can't teach that what we had in the past is continuing to influence society today, which is, of course, absurd.
You know, and the sense was, too, that it just, it was like, it was something that didn't really exist, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's
in spite of, like, plenty of evidence that, you know, there was redlining and, you know, stuff that went on in Missouri and Tulsa and all this stuff in history, you know, that it didn't exist, that it wasn't right, you know.
Yeah, and that it doesn't have any implications on how things are today. It doesn't matter what the idea is, though, right? Like, the problem here is that the government is putting their finger on the scale and saying, you can go into the classroom. Here's eight things that you can criticize in the classroom all you want, but if you take one of these ideas and endorse it or advance it, whatever that means, right? Because I think, you know, a lot of education is professors, playing devil's advocate or engaging the Socratic method by challenging students on things that they may, you know, feel are core assumptions or core beliefs of theirs. And professors challenging them on those things for the purpose of educating them, that's not discriminatory harassment, that's education.
Yeah, and I guess kind of the root of this, you know, it was, you know, it at least expressed in one of the Supreme Court justices' dissent is that because, you know, professors are paid by the state, that is, I guess, quote unquote, state-sponsored speech, and that the state mm-hmm. should be able to regulate that, right? I mean, isn't this was that, you know, sort of key to their to this law?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's what the majority said was a breathtaking assertion of power, that because we pay the salary of professors at public colleges, we get to dictate what viewpoints they teach in the classroom. And that is a theory that has not been accepted. It is sort of unlimited control then by the state over public education, the viewpoints taught in public education from the time that you are in kindergarten through grad school. And I think the dangers of it are, you know, the Levin Circuit did a great job of explaining what the problems are with that. And, you know, people go to college to learn how to think, not be told what to think. And this is, that's exactly why the Stop Woke Act was so dangerous, and that it would not have any limiting principle. If that theory was accepted, we could have 50 different states with 50 different versions of the Stop Woke Act. And I can guarantee you that it would not just be eight things that they would tell students what to think about. They would have eventually a really long list of things things that they want taught in a certain way, and that is not conducive to excellent education.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second for those just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Greg Grubel, an attorney for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Yeah, going back to what Barbara Loggia wrote, you know, and I think she almost contradicts herself, you know, pointing out that while the First Amendment protects all viewpoints, it does not compel that all viewpoints are worthy of state-sponsored endorsement. You know, and that why I say that contradicts, because that goes the other way, too. Aren't they trying to say that, you know, we want to dictate what you're allowed to teach? So I guess we're placing our value judgment on what's right and wrong, right? I mean, and that's kind of contradictory.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and they're not, you know, nobody's compelling anybody to believe anything here. And that's not what was going on. What the problem is that the state was trying to get that power to actually do that. The only way that you can get into a system where the state gets to tell professors and students what to think is by allowing them to have complete control over the viewpoints that they teach. And that's what they were trying to do here with the Stop Woke Act, and the First Amendment does not permit that. And that's exactly what the majority opinion laid out in really, you know, forceful opinion that did not go along with that idea.
Yeah. You know, I know your case focused on because it's in your name, I guess. Well, education used to be in your name, you know, focused on the university case, you know, but, you know, the court throwing this part of the Stop Woke Act out had, you know, other effects, Florida. I mean, doesn't it have an effect on how companies now can do race training, race sensitivity training, and other things?
Yeah, that was an earlier decision by the 11th Circuit in an opinion of the Title Honey Fund that struck down the private or the use of the Stop Woke Act in private employers. So it was doing a similar thing as what it was doing here with in higher education, but as applied to private employers, basically. So that was held to be unconstitutional as well.
So what happens now? You know, I know that it seems like these you know political disagreements, you know, that get taken to court, you know, seem to be, we're in a time when, you know, they're appealed endlessly. Is this kind of the end of it? I know that the DeSantis administration and Uthmeyer, you know, have not yet commented. Well, they've commented on it, but haven't said if they're going to make another move. Do you know anything more about that?
No, I don't know anything more than what's been said publicly by the DeSantis administration. They have been indicating that they don't think that the court got it right and that they're going to appeal. We would welcome that appeal and look forward to continuing to fight for the First Amendment right faculty in Florida.
Yeah, and actually, too, though, you know, I mean, I guess this is the other point that I want to bring up, is that, you know, there had been a preliminary injunction on this, so, you know, none of this stuff that they were trying to do was actually being done, but it, mm-hmm. didn't it have some impact? I mean, on professors and how they taught and what their life was like.
Yeah, it definitely did. You know, I think whenever there's something where there's a preliminary injunction, but it hasn't, it's still on appeal, and you know, the state is saying that they expect to win on appeal, and you know, are sort of culturally trying to say that they were right despite the legal ruling, that did have an impact on professors in Florida. And, you know, it's now that we've gotten the 11th Circuit's opinion on this, I think that you'll start to see professors maybe speaking up a little bit more about ways in which their teaching has been influenced, you know, knowing that there is a strong opinion out there about what can and cannot be done by the state in terms of controlling viewpoints in the classroom. It's really impossible to know the full scope of the impact of censorship, because oftentimes the folks that actually censor themselves they do so because they're afraid of the consequences of speaking up, and that means that pretty much nobody really knows about it, including myself. And we do our best here at FIRE to give folks channels to come and let us know about what's going on, try to give them the courage to speak up, because we will be there to help out if we're able to. But, you know, I'm not going to act like it's not a difficult position for, let's say, a young professor with little kids and worrying about their paycheck to, you know, speak up and potentially risk their career. You know, Dr. Noboa has remained employed at the University of South Florida throughout this litigation, and I think that I hope that will send a signal to professors that have been told things about what they can teach in the classroom and how they can teach it, that they may start speaking up now, and that we'll get some more insight into things that have been going on that we haven't been able to find out about.
Yeah, you know, that while this you know, court ruling was, you know, a very important step, you know, I guess it is important to recognize, you know, here in Florida, you know, the Board of Governors that regulates universities is pretty political, you know, and that, you know, there's other ways they can, I guess, describe what a professor might be doing, you know, that isn't really an issue as an issue. And hurt them. I mean, are you expecting maybe? And I don't mean to be facetious here. You know, to get some more business from you know, Florida college professors.
Yeah, I don't. You never know, right? It's always a hard thing to predict. But I will say that, you know, one of the most important things here at FIRE is that we get these. You know, we spend a lot of time and effort in getting. Wins in the courtroom about things like academic freedom and the First Amendment rights of public employees. But it's really, we also engage in campaigns to make sure that folks actually understand the value of the First Amendment and free and robust debate. Our president, Greg Lukianoff, has done an amazing job throughout his career of making those arguments to folks. Right, left, and center, and trying to persuade people that you might not like what someone has to say, but you should defend their right to say it. And, you know, we are continually making these arguments, not just in court, but also in the court of public opinion, because we know that if you don't have folks that want to actually engage in free and robust debate, that there is no law that will save us. This is ultimately about individuals making the right conclusions for themselves, and that's been a major part of what we've been doing here at FIRE, is making these arguments, not just in court, but out in public to, you know, regular folks, and making sure that they understand the values of the First Amendment and why we have it and why we need it for the future to remain, you know, such a great country.
Great. You know, Greg, coming to the end of my segment, and I really want to thank you, Greg Grubel from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, you know, for making time for us today. And please tell my listeners how they can learn more about the foundation and the work you're up to.
Yeah, you can go to fire.org. That's our website. You can find a lot about our cases there. You'll find up in the right-hand corner, a button where you can submit a case if you feel that your First Amendment rights have been violated. We will review every single one of those that comes in. You'll also have an opportunity to donate to FIRE if you are fired up about this. And I hope you do. You know, it takes a lot to do this kind of work, and we couldn't do it without all the folks that give generously, donate to the organization, and I like to think that we do quite a bit with every dollar that we get. So every little bit helps. So if folks can, you know, go and Check out our work, and if you like it, which I hope you do, you know, consider supporting it, because we do. We are a group of nonpartisan people that really want the best for the country and are trying to do our best to make that happen.
Great. Thanks again, Greg. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Getting out of Dodge when a hurricane is on the way just got easier for those who can afford it. Florida has a new niche industry to help those who can afford it get out of Dodge before a hurricane whirls ashore. A newly launched company in Florida proposes a way to avoid getting stuck on the highway or gouged by last-minute commercial or charter flights. You can buy, essentially, an annual hurricane season pass that saves a seat on a private evacuation flight out of Florida. Priority Evac launched this summer, and it's selling seats on a plane that would leave from major Florida airports and take evacuees to Atlanta. For $1,250 a year per person, it's good for two separate storms in one season. Pets can come for an additional $125. Priority Evac's tagline is evacuation elevated, and a section of its website makes a pitch for selling its product to high net worth or HNW individuals. The company lists insurance brokers and agents, residential property managers, wealth management, and private aviation operators as natural fits for their referral service. Florida has seen an influx of high net worth individuals in the past few years, along with services trying to cater to them. HNW households asked their broker, advisor, board, or property manager how to evacuate when a storm threatens. The honest answer until now has been, "We don't have a good one," the site says. Founder Jason Murgio said he considers his product as an affordable alternative to private charter planes, which could easily run into the low five figures per flight, or a last-minute self-charter, this site said. This would have probably been much easier to do if we aimed for a smaller service on private planes, he said. The whole point was to have something that was reasonably priced and something that many people could use versus something that is very finite and has a very high price point. The concept came to Murgio after a friend complained about the difficulties and expense of evacuating Florida to New York ahead of a storm. Murgio, longtime member of the insurance industry, saw a business idea. "I said to myself, there's got to be a better way to do this," he told the Herald. South Florida is the first spot he's launched in, but the goal is to make the service to North Florida and beyond, potentially other Gulf states as well. Priority Evac's pitch is that people can pre-book a seat on a plane leaving from six major coastal airports, Miami International, Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, President Donald J. Trump International, Tampa International, Sarasota, Bradenton International, and Southwest Florida International. When a specific storm threshold is triggered, usually by tropical storm warnings for the region, the company starts scheduling flights, and lets each member know what time theirs leaves. That way, they can skip the hassle of trying to rent a car, fight through turnpike traffic, or snag one of the few seats on a commercial flight out of town. If a storm doesn't happen that season, Priority Evac keeps the $1,250 fee. It's like paying an annual insurance premium for a one-way plane ticket off the coast. Murgio said the annual fee is a bargain compared to some of the costs he's heard. Someone in the industry even told him that he paid $1,800 for a car service from Miami to Orlando and then $2,000 in last-minute airfare to get his college student daughter home to New York ahead of a hurricane. Another said plane tickets out of Tampa ahead of one of the recent hurricanes were $1,400 to $3,000. His service assures that paying members have a seat on a large plane reserved solely for Priority Evac members. It doesn't come with a flight home, though. We're in the evacuation business. We're not a travel coordinator, he said. New data shows that the migration boom in Florida is slowly dissipating, with counties like Miami-Dade and Broward actually losing residents, according to a recent report. According to the June report from Schimberg Center for Housing Studies at the University of Florida, migration to Florida fell sharply in 2025, especially in high-cost communities. This comes after a migration boom in 2022, where Florida welcomed 598,737,000 residents, or on the average, 1,640 per day, the report said. However, in 2025, migration fell to 201,191,000 people, which equated to about 551 people per day. Particularly high urban communities were high-cost urban communities were the most affected by the drop. According to Schimberg, Miami-Dade led the state in domestic out-migration in 2025, with a loss of nearly 73,000 residents to other counties and states.